Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Sometimes people say it's $6 for 3 marshmallows, but it's $6 for local food. It's $6 in the community. Those things do cost more, but you get what you pay for.
That's Sam Aulick of 240 Sweet. Their artisan marshmallows made in Columbus, Indiana, would make amazing s'mores at any 4th of July cookout. We visit their shop to check out some of the more interesting flavors they offer. After that, Chef Daniel Orr cooks up some mushrooms he foraged for. That's right, we're doing dessert first today. A local bartender mixes together some fresh cocktails to enjoy on the porch. And finally, we sit down with 3 members of the local Growers Guild to find out how they're working to better connect local food producers with local food eaters. Stay with us. But first, here's a look at the latest headlines in food news. Mia Partlow is out of the office this week, flexing her reporting and producing muscles at the Public Radio News Directors Incorporated Conference in Houston, Texas. So filling in today is Anna Coogan. Thanks for being here, Anna.
Hey, Annie. The hot temperatures and dry conditions across the Midwest lead off the news this week. Local farmers are being hit especially hard since almost 80% of the state is experiencing at least moderate drought. Jody Ellett of Generate Farm says her soil is dry a foot down. But Hoosiers aren't alone. A stretch of the Midwest reaching west to Kansas and south to Arkansas is experiencing a dry period in the heart of corn-growing territory. If the drought continues, U.S. government and insurance companies are likely to be hit with crop insurance payments. And as demand for corn, as food and feed, is unyielding, consumers are likely to see prices rise as well. And food writers took to the wires this week to celebrate the life of screenwriter and passionate foodie Nora Ephron. Food always played an important role in her films, including When Harry Met Sally and her final film, Julie and Julia. According to the Los Angeles Times, Ephron was among the first writers to show that it is possible to enjoy food, take it seriously, and joke about it at the same time. In her 2006 op-ed for the New York Times, Ephron wrote, quote, "Here's the thing about dessert. It's so bad for you so much of the time, and as with all bad things, you want it to last as long as possible. But you can't make it last if they give you a great big spoon to eat it with." Unquote. Read more news headlines from across the food world on our social media platforms. On Twitter and Facebook, just search for Earth Eats.
And check out our website to read even more news articles from the world of food, gardening, sustainability, and beyond, eartheats.org. Anna Coogan, thanks so much.
You bet. It was fun.
There's always work to be done on the farm, but often it's the same work day after day after day. Parts of the job must feel a bit like an assembly line. Wouldn't it be great if you could just get a robot to do it? That might not be so far off. As Jeremy Burnfield explains in part 2 of Harvest Public Media series Farmer of the Future.
No, it's not a Kentucky Derby video game. It's a farm robot that could be used to plant seed or spread fertilizer. Only problem is it's just ankle high and about a foot long. It had taken an awful long time to plant a 5,000-acre farm. The small four-wheeled machine drops coffee grains from its bottom at specific locations. It has 3 little sensors that read where the crops are and keeps the machine exactly 10 inches away. The robot travels the perimeter of the crop area and drops a pellet every inch.
It's building on what's currently there and looking towards what we would see happen in the future.
That's Joe Dvorak. He's a grad student at Kansas State University and was the president of the Biological and Agricultural Engineering Department's robotics team, which won national robotics competitions in each of the last 5 years. Last year's was in Louisville, hence the equine theme. Dvorak and his team built the robot, and he and another of his teammates showed it to me in a classroom at K-State in Manhattan. It's not hard to see how it could be used for farm work.
The whole idea behind them is very applicable. If we're doing it on a small scale, it just needs to be scaled up to work at a larger scale.
Sounds a bit crazy, right? Like a science fiction novel. Robots running around the field, growing our food.
Luke! Take these 2 over to the garage, will you? I want them cleaned up for dinner. Well, come on, Red, let's go!
In the Star Wars movies, moisture farmers use droids and robots on farms in a galaxy far, far away. But they've also got flying cars, so could we really see robots on the farm? Farmers today already rely heavily on advanced technology like GPS systems, automatic dairy milkers, and satellite imaging. It's heady stuff.
Robotics and autonomy become appropriate where you have a situation which is dull, which is dirty, or which is dangerous.
That's Jeremy Brown, president of JBridge Robotics, a Massachusetts-based company that makes software that helps turn regular machinery into robotic machinery for commercial use. He says agriculture is a fruitful place for robotics. In fact, JBridge and tractor manufacturer Kinze developed a robotic tractor, and it's set to head to market in limited release this fall. To be clear, robot tractors in the field this fall. It's all thanks to sensors. They're continuously becoming more advanced, cheaper, and more rugged so they can be used in the field. Robotics is all about a machine reacting to the world around it. Farmers already have tractors that drive in super straight lines by themselves thanks to GPS auto steer technology. Throw in sensors that allow it to back up, change gears when heading up or downhill, detect objects in the field, and you've got a robot harvesting your wheat. The robot tractor and robotic milking machines are the two main areas robotics are already being used in U.S. agriculture. And researchers are currently working on applications that could be used in planting, harvesting, weeding crops, and spreading fertilizer. Robots aren't yet common on farms, but it's headed that way.
There is one factor that will actually accelerate these kind of things.
That's Dr. Tom Zhang. He's a professor in agricultural and biological sciences at K-State and the robotics team's mentor. He says that in places like Japan, South Korea, and even China, a declining farm labor force is pushing robots into the mainstream faster. That may be a harbinger for U.S. farms.
Eventually, someday, we need to have a much more robotic automated machines. So that farmers do not have to that many farmers to do the farming work. So that will happen eventually, but it's not going to happen very quickly, like in Japan, like in South Korea, like in China.
Farms have huge labor and expense demands, but often only at two or three times a year, like planting and harvest. It's hard for a farmer to employ year-round the laborers he needs for the busy times. A robot able to do some of that work would surely help. Again, JBridge's Jeremy Brown.
The farmers actually have been quite enthusiastic in sort of seeing what this can do and how it can help them with sort of having predictable harvest times and to be able to do longer hours with fewer people if necessary.
Does this spell the end for the flesh and blood human farmer? Absolutely not. Today's modern farmer is the CEO of his or her farm, every day making important business decisions, using complex financial instruments, and managing a workforce. That won't change. Even Brown, the robotic software engineer, says his company isn't trying to replace farmers, only help them.
There's very much of a human element in all of the business decisions and all of the equipment selection and maintenance and fleet decisions. So, you know, I don't think you're going to eliminate the farmer with automation.
With robots on the way, the role of the farmer may have to change to adapt to new tools. But they've done that for centuries. See many oxen teams around? The farmer of the future isn't a robot. Even in our wildest imaginations, we still rely on farmers.
I mean, even if we look at Star Wars, just to run with that, you know, Luke's aunt and uncle were human farmers. They had robot farm hands.
Robot farm hands of the future, though? It's rapidly changing from science fiction to science fact. Jeremy Bernfeld, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media's Farmer of the Future series continues next week as Jessica Najunas finds out what sustainability means to farmers in Kansas and Nebraska. The ladies of 240 Sweet in Columbus, Indiana, started making marshmallows in 2008 as a way of advertising their catering business. Eventually, there was as much demand for the marshmallows as there was for the catering. So they bought a high-powered mixer, hired some friends and family to help around the kitchen, and then found themselves breaking new ground in the world of sweet confections.
Hi, Annie.
I'm Alexa.
Hi, cool.
This is Sam.
Hi, Annie. I'm Sam.
Chef Alexa Lemley is the marshmallow mastermind of the operation, and Sam Olek is her partner. Both raised in southern Indiana, they pride themselves on using local and organic ingredients.
There's so much going on in here. Is this an everyday thing or is this just a Friday
thing?
Oh, it's
calm today.
It's calm today?
Uh-huh.
Their marshmallows have some pretty famous fans, including Oprah Winfrey, who listed buying 240 Sweet's marshmallows as a New Year's resolution for 2012. But in the beginning, They had a hard time getting foodies to buy into what they were doing.
When we first started making marshmallows, it was really an abstract concept to people because we were all used to seeing the jet puff ones. And so when I even applied to go to farmers markets, I got turned down because people thought we were taking mass-produced marshmallows and rolling them in toppings. And so this is an original recipe from Alexa. It is hers, and it is fabulous, isn't it?
I stopped by their facility in Columbus, Indiana, just as they were rolling out their marshmallows of the month for January. Peanut butter, banana, caramel, chocolate chip, and the Year of the Dragon Crunch.
Talk about the basic ingredients, then, in your marshmallows.
Well, we use Michigan beet sugar because we try to use local, and also beet sugar is minimally processed, and it's vegetarian. Even though our marshmallows aren't vegetarian, we try to use as much natural as we can. We also use Indiana cornstarch. This is local heavy cream. Now, there aren't any local vanilla beans, so we use organic Tahitian ones. Yeah. Oh, Alexa has some marshmallows for you.
Well, let's give this a shot. Let's do the caramel one.
That has Maldon sea salt and Alexa's handmade caramel with heavy whipping cream in it and some nice chocolate chips there.
Okay. This is the best way to have this, is slightly toasted and super gooey.
Oh, I think so. I think you can taste more of the flavor elements when they're toasted.
It's so good.
Yeah. Well, let's walk over to the big wall o' marshmallows.
Certainly.
150 flavors, is that what you said?
Over 150 now in our repertoire, yes.
Okay, so give me some of the weirder ones.
Beef. And the I know the beef is, well, actually, we made it originally for our dogs, and people love it. Especially at the farmers markets, teenage boys will buy it like a Fear Factor thing. And then we make turkey with sage dressing for Thanksgiving. Now, the key lime one, I've been known to hollow those out and put shots of tequila in them. That's really good.
Sweet potato and ginger.
Well, this is actually Candy's is ginger herself. It's dried ginger. And then she uses organic sweet potatoes, which is one of the things you'll notice as you look at the packages, that some marshmallows are taller than others. Well, that's because we use real food. And real food makes things have different textures and different flavors and different sizes, as opposed to a flavoring, which would be consistent all of the time.
What is your favorite flavor?
Oh, my favorite's definitely lemonade. Alexa takes organic lemons that she zests and she juices, and she incorporates them into the marshmallow mix. Well, I like the lemonade best toasted. Because we use powdered sugar and cornstarch on the outside, they get a crust, they brulee. And I like that crunch combined with the melty inside. So good.
So let's talk about your local seasonal desires, sourcing your ingredients from around the area. In terms of your cost?
Well, you know, that does make the marshmallows a little more expensive than they would be if we used artificial colors and flavorings and things. So sometimes people say it's $6 for 3 marshmallows. But it's $6 for local food. It's $6 for what we try to do, a fair wage. It's $6 in the community. We use all made in America packaging. It's $6 for that. Those things do cost more, but you get what you pay for.
Check out their website to find out what the flavors of the month are for July. For June, some fun options: lavender lemonade, crunchy peanut butter, and strawberry basil. Their website is 240sweet.com. Working backwards through our meal now, Chef Daniel Orr is cooking up some local mushrooms.
So I want to share with you a wonderful recipe for mushroom skewers. We're going to be using chanterelles that I took my folks out in the woods and we harvested. All right, so I've taken my skewers and I've soaked them in water. You want to soak them in water for at least a couple hours. And what that does is it will prevent them from burning on the grill. Then I've got a portobello mushroom here. I'm going to cut that into eighths so I get some nice meaty chunks. I love portobellos because they are almost like a vegetarian meat substitute. They've got such a toothsome texture to them. And then I also have some creminis. Now, a lot of people don't know that creminis are just baby portobellos. So when these guys grow up, they'll turn into portobellos. So I'm going to put a couple of those on and then a few of the chanterelles. And the chanterelles have a nice, crunchy, toothsome texture as well. So they almost have an apricot flavor with a touch of cinnamon. And then what we're going to do is we're going to make a quick little marinade for the mushrooms. Smash up a little bit of garlic. Just lay that on your cutting board. and we're going to chop it up. And then on top of that, we're going to add some olive oil, some fresh thyme leaves, and then we're going to add just a little bit of acid, which will be, in this case, we're going to use a little bit of lemon juice. Okay, while we're letting that sit, I'm going to make the dressing for this, which we're going to make a truffle vinaigrette. We've got some olive oil, some lemon zest, adding a little bit of cider vinegar. Cider vinegar has a touch of sweetness to it, so it's not just like a white vinegar, which is total acid. Then we have the almighty truffle oil here, and you just need a little bit. It's just going to give a perfume. It's very, very strong, very aromatic, has a wonderful flavor. But you don't want to use too much because it can just take over things, dominate it. The other thing that's great about that truffle oil is that when it hits something warm, like that heat really brings out those essential oils from the truffle oil and makes the perfume just waft up. All right, as your mushrooms are grilling, you can get your salad together. I'm using some endive, and the reason I like that is it has such a nice pale color, touch of bitterness, so it's really going to kind of make those mushroom skewers pop when you put it on top of them. Okay, and then we're going to whisk up that vinaigrette that we had to make sure that everything's equally distributed. Of course, give it a taste, and that just tastes wonderful. It has that nice balance with the acidity, the sweetness, almost a meatiness to it.
Chanterelles pop up all over the country anytime between June and September. It just depends on rainfall and temperatures. In Indiana, we can expect to start looking for them in late summer. What about your neck of the woods? Let us know when your favorite wild foods come into season by sending us an email to eartheats@gmail.com. Coming up...
I think it'll be a really long time before we've like saturated that market or people are tired of hearing about it. I've never been in a community that's so aware and current when it comes to food issues.
That's Megan Betts of the Local Growers Guild. According to her, demand for local food is just going up. She talks about the possibility of creating a local food hub as a way of getting more local food on area plates. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every week, we speak with authors who've written everything from cookbooks to food history books, and we feature snippets of those interviews here on the program. Our book today is Eat Your Roses by Denise Schreiber. It's a cookbook with tips for cultivating an edible flower garden. Her interest in snacking on flowers started way back when she was a kid.
And me and the little boy next door would actually kind of chew on them, and, you know, you make mud pies, and like, here, eat this flower. It's a wonder I survived childhood.
Here's 1 minute with Denise Schreiber, where she talks about cooking nasturtiums.
Nasturtiums actually have quite a peppery flavor to them. The leaves are edible, the stems are edible, the flowers are edible, and we've done two dishes that are really popular with them. One is the recipe in the book for the roasted red pepper soup. And you can use jarred roasted red peppers, and you just drain them. And you add your tomato juice and your vegetable juice and puree it. Then add the shredded nasturtiums. Nasturtiums have to be added at the last moment. They don't have any flavor when they're dried, and you get the bite of the nasturtium leaves when you add them at the last minute, so the flavor isn't destroyed. That's one of the most popular dishes. The other was something we did last year at our food fest. We marinated some pork butts, and we did a roasted red pepper coulis with it and added the nasturtiums. And they were just mini pork sliders, and we ran out of them. They were so popular. Thanks a lot, Annie.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Read more about edible flowers from Denise Schreiber on our website and find plenty of other interviews with authors, chefs, and food activists. EarthEats.org. According to the USDA, more than 7,000 farmers markets were in operation across the country in 2011, more than double the number of markets 10 years earlier. With the value of the expanding local food market likely to surpass $7 billion by the end of 2012, producers of all sizes are trying to figure out even more ways to serve consumers. That's where local food hubs come in. A major part of the USDA's Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food initiative, food hubs are places where local food from a variety of producers is aggregated, graded, processed, packaged, and then delivered to area buyers, whether they be restaurants, wholesale markets, or individuals just looking to snag a couple pounds of tomatoes.
And so the food hub concept is something that can help supply a community with the food that they're actually using.
That's Jody Ellett, board member of the local Growers Guild and farmer of Generate Farms in Ellettsville, Indiana, a town settled by her ancestors way back in the 1820s. She was joined by board president Jonathan Jenner and local Growers Guild intern Megan Betts.
So I think the numbers, the estimated numbers for Bloomington is that we have 77,000 tons of food that we sort of consume in this town every year. And we're local growers are supplying about maybe 1.5% of that. And I think if you have a food hub and if you have a place where growers can sell, they'll grow it.
One of the ways I think about the food hub, too, not to like burden it with, you know, ridiculous language, but I think of it as just lowering transactions costs between farmers and restaurants and stuff. Just the incredible amount of go-between of what do you have? How much of that do you have? How much does it cost? How much can I get? And when you think about restaurants and institutions which have so much and need to get, you know, weekly commitments for X amount of stuff, it's just an incredible amount of time there. And what this food hub does is kind of agglomerates that data, puts it together, and makes it really easy to enter data and really easy to look at large amounts of data just in terms of what food is available.
Hearing you talk about this, it's making me think of the gigantic Sysco trucks that pull up in front of restaurants and just drop off who knows how much food weekly. So is the food hub trying to be a local version of that?
A lot of these distribution companies aren't just carriers of food. They have the paper towels, the soap, the everything that the restaurant needs, and it's very convenient for a restaurant to do one-stop shopping. I don't blame them. You know, it's really – they're busy. They can get it the next day. These places have warehouses. And so what a food hub of local food can provide is at least a mechanism for a restaurant to have another option. It may take a little extra effort on the part of the buyer, but not as much as it's currently taking.
Like you mentioned earlier, you can be any level buyer, whether there are a couple of weeks in the fall when you want to buy loads of squash and store them for the winter, or you're a restaurant and you're looking for, you know, a constant supply of greens. It really is for anyone at any size on any side of the market.
I was reading an article that said if you ask any farmer, their least favorite thing they do is distribution and marketing. You're nodding your head. You're a local farmer too. So why do you hate that so much?
There are a few professions where people have to be so versatile, you know, and so skilled in so many areas. I love selling at the farmer's market, and I love the farmer camaraderie. It's sort of the modern-day equivalent of what might used to happen maybe at the grain tower in the mornings, you know. But the sort of time that you spend preparing and getting to market, selling at market, marketing your product, maintaining a website, maintaining a listserv, communicating with people individually and in groups, you know, it's a very time-consuming thing, and that is an issue.
And, you know, when I was first looking into this, I thought, what odd business practice to sort of work together with your competitors. Isn't that going to reduce the amount of food that you can sell and therefore reduce your profits? But it's sounding like together, local farmers, small producers are stronger.
That's exactly what's going on in this country, and it's phenomenal. It's success story after success story, especially in communities like Bloomington, where there's a far greater demand for local food than is being met. I mean, I think...
Yeah. And again, I mean, we already have certain venues for buying food, but instead of competing for that 1.5% of the food economy that is local food, we see this as blowing that up and making that a much bigger percentage.
I think it'll be a really long time before we've like saturated that market or people are tired of hearing about it. I've never been in a community that's so aware and current when it comes to food issues that I think it'll be latched onto pretty quickly.
Yeah.
This has been awesome. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Back to the kitchen, or rather behind the bar at Farm Bloomington. We're mixing together a couple delicious cocktails. The first is a basilica, which is basically a martini with tequila, and then a non-alcoholic blackberry and mint tonic. We hung out with bartender Christina way back in 2009.
Martinis are fun because you can use lots of different flavors. You can use lots of different ingredients. We use all different kinds of sweeteners. We use simple syrup, sugar, agave nectar. You can use sodas such as Sprite or ginger ale. And then, you know, most people have never even thought of doing a tequila martini. Going to muddle some agave nectar. It's a natural sweetener. Just kind of smush everything and get all the flavors out from the herbs and the fruit. And this one you want to use a clear tequila. Top it off a little bit of Sprite. And shake it. Nice when you muddle the herbs, you get a little bit of the specks in the cocktail and it makes it decorative as well as flavorful. All right, this drink is a non-alcoholic drink. I'm going to use some bitters right now. I'm going to put some mint in there. I like to pull the leaves off just so you don't get the bitterness of the stem. Put some lime in there. Muddle it up. Get all those flavors out. I'm going to put a few blackberries in there and put those in at the end because I don't want to totally mush them. I just want to kind of lightly bruise them. I'm going to top this with some ice. And then this one is just getting tonic water. I'm going to just toss it back and forth to get all the flavors mixed in. And it makes it more decorative. Put some mint in there. And we'll top with a few blackberries. And...
check out a photo slideshow of Christina mixing these drinks on our website, where you can find plenty of other drink recipes that use herbs picked fresh from the garden and even using some local spirits. Our website is a great place to find inspiration, eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh local organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop, and Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Next week on Earth Eats, Stephanie Hartono takes a look at the carbon footprint of her latte from farm to cup. Be sure to come back for that. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Annie Corrigan.